There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It did mean that on the estate, I got this nickname of long word alert. Long word. It's like they've used a lot of syllables to accuse me of being long-winded. And, you know, explaining that irony to them is probably why I got punched in the face.
This week on Walking the Dog, I was joined by comedian Jeff Norcott and his cockapoo Lily from their home in Cambridgeshire. I also introduced him to my dog Raymond. Jeff said he had too much hair and his eyes were red. Look, we've all let ourselves go a bit in lockdown. Give the guy a break, Jeff. You'll probably be familiar with Jeff from his TV outings on Mock the Week, Live at the Apollo and the MASH Report, and he's also known for his political appearances on shows like Question Time. Jeff's fascinating to talk to. We chatted about his childhood growing up in South London, his brilliantly charismatic parents, and how he always had a sense of being quite mature and adulted. Jeff also told me about his years as a teacher and why he always insisted on discipline in his classrooms before moving into comedy, where he really found his natural home. We talked too about some of the tough times he's gone through with loss, and I loved how honest and open he was about how that's affected him. Jeff's just fabulous company. He's not only hilarious, he's also this brilliant blend of kind of sensitive and solid. He's the kind of person you could call about a broken heart or a burst tire. In fact, I fully intend to call him about both of those things in future. He's also written a fantastic book called Where Did I Go Right, which charts his journey both personally and politically towards the centre-right, and I honestly can't recommend it enough. It's a brilliant read. Do check out his podcast too, What Most People Think, and find out more about his forthcoming tour, I Blame the Parents, on jeffnorcott.co.uk. I really hope you enjoyed my chat with Jeff as much as I did. If you did, please remember to rate, review and subscribe. I'll stop talking now so you can hear from the man himself. Here's Jeff and Lily.
What breed is it? I can't see because of the light. I'm really sorry about my hair. There you go. Look at that, sorted.
That's the best start to a podcast I've ever had.
There you go. Just one flick. This is one of the great things, one of the great liberties of being a man, is that you probably thought I'd go, I'm going to leave the room and I'm going to comb my hair or something. But what I did was I just ran my hair across it and only partially resolved how bad it looks. But that's enough for me because I'm mummy's little soldier.
The thing is, Jeff, no one has hair like my dog. Can you see my dog?
I can. There are one or two lighting issues. I've got to be honest that the eyes are just vaguely perceptible. So it's looking a bit evil. Yeah, I know that your dog is not evil. What is your dog's name?
He's called Raymond. I imagine you'd approve of that name.
I like Ray, yeah, I think, because there's always that issue, isn't there, of giving dogs pseudo-human names, but there are certain ones that still strike you as original, and shouting out Ray would still be a surprisingly human name rather than a kind of off-the-peg human name, like Colin or something.
I liked it because he just sounded like a decent pub regular, and that's what, yeah, I wanted.
I'm not sure you get men like Ray anymore, do you know what I mean?
You don't.
You just steadily drink 3 pints on a Saturday afternoon and have advice about something. Just know about something. There's a whole generation of names like that that you do wonder if they've just become extinct. But I do think, when I think of Ray, I think Ray has got, he'll keep screws from things, you know, like in different tins, and he recognises the value of an Allen key.
I love this podcast so much already. I need to introduce you properly. I'm so excited because I'm such a huge fan of this man's. I'm with the very fabulous comedian and author, Jeff Norcott. I'm worried about the way I said your name. I said Jeff Norcott, and it should be Jeff Norcott.
Well, yeah, but it's a weird name, isn't it? It's just odd. It's really incongruous. And it was also my dad's name, and I've always found it a bit odd that they road tested the name for 30 odd years, and I don't think it was good then. And they thought, well, let's just give this another run out. Because the standard thing now is that you name kids after grandparents, don't you? So you get all these cute names like Elsie or Reg. that's generally the way that you do it. But they were just trying to have immediate name continuity. I've never really liked my name. I don't think it's a cool name.
Jeffrey, or just the whole name?
Well, Jeffrey, there's only, like, only my sister really calls me Jeffrey. It does sound quite like, it could sound quite indulgent if someone said both syllables. If one of my mates called me Jeffrey, I'd think it was weird. If he just said, oh, hello, Jeffrey, it would sound like our relationship was going to the next level.
Well, you've pointed out in your fabulous book, which we're going to talk about a lot in this podcast, but a name like Jeffrey, I think, I'm paraphrasing you here, but to me, it's either you're either Chancellor of the Exchequer or you're an electrician, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that duality is something that they're definitely in me. You know, it's either Jaguar dealership. You know, like there's that one Jeffrey Salmon Jaguar dealership. It's one of those names. But then Jeff, you just take out, there's no middle ground in this name. You abbreviate it to Jeff. That's a completely different person. That's a Scouse bricklayer. I think that there's definitely a part of me that is backward looking a bit. And so it wouldn't be a car that was popular now. It would be a brand of car. And this is already getting very sort of therapy, like, that's just about hanging in there.
Jeff, this is called Walking the Dog. I wasn't able to meet up with you because, you know, COVID. But I do want to know about your dog. Is your dog with you at the moment?
She is, although this is normally the bit of the day where she chills out. Lily! Oh, hang on, she's coming. Hang about, sorry. So we've had our big walk and she's had her breakfast and stuff. So she's a cockapoo, so she's pretty smart. She just knows that I've got nothing for her right now. But we've done a big walk this morning, did an hour.
Tell me about Lily. When did you get her?
So we got her in 2011. I remember because I was thinking about, you know, doing this podcast, and I was thinking about when we got her and what a big responsibility I thought that was, because I'd always said to my wife when we got married, like, we spoke about kids. Neither of us were fully intent on having kids, but I said, we're going to work our way up through the gears. We're going to get a cat, then we're going to get a dog, then it was an alpaca, and then just like a elephant or something. But it felt like a postponement strategy. But then my mum died in 2009, and then a couple of years after that, I was sort of ready to love something, you know, have a bit of new love in my life. And that sounded romantic. I mean, to love a living thing. I'll just move on. And I remember we went up there. My wife, like, she is very, not impulsive, but when she loves something, she wants to have it straight away. So with the first house that we bought, she offered the asking price on the spot so quickly that the estate agent actually said, would you not want to knock off a grand or something? And if an estate agent is saying that, you have to feel like you've gone in a bit exposed. But I mean, we was driving
it's
up.
It's like when a drug dealer says, do you think maybe you need to take it easy for a few weeks? You've been having a few nights.
Or a black cab driver goes, you know what, mate, you might as well walk. That's basically what had happened. And we went up there, and I remember it was this breeder in Lincoln, because cockapoos are so expensive around the home counties. They're about a grand, but, and that was back then. I don't know what they are now. But up in Lincoln, if you're willing to do the drive, you get one for about 650 quid. It's so tragic, isn't it, when you think about dogs, once we start talking about the cost of them, it's 650 quid. How much did your dog cost?
That's classified. If you want to know, you can ask Catherine Ryan, who's a mutual friend of ours.
You paid big money, I can tell. Okay, can I just respond now to, can I say that I've found out the figure? And it is, well, she didn't buy in Lincoln. Put it that way. Well, it's a good dog, you know, and it looks a bit evil. That's what, you know, you get. I know that your dog's not evil, but we went
not evil, but he is quite standoffish, which I like in a dog.
Yeah, that's normally a cat thing, isn't it? Lily's got that as well, because the cocker and the poo, right? The cocker is the intrepid thing that goes out and sniffs things out, and then the poodle is the thing that just goes, look at me, just admire me, drink me in. And I quite like that. And she was pretty chilled out when we went up. So there was this breeder, and she had the three puppies in this pen that was perfectly adequately sized for movement for those people that listen. And the brother was a bit old, bit bigger and a bit of a doofus. And I thought, I don't want him. And then there was a younger sister that was just a bit like it had PTSD already from something, just shaking in the corner. You can hear her barking now. And then Lily just went up to my wife, and I could tell immediately that we were going home with a dog that day. That's the story, basically, is that my wife, and I thought, here we are. This is the estate agent thing all over again. I'm going to try and haggle for the price of this dog, and you are already crying and hugging it, and you've clearly bonded. So we came home with a dog that day.
And you've got a little boy, Sebastian, haven't you?
Yes, yeah.
So he's grown up with the dog. I mean, he doesn't sort of know any different. He's grown up in a dog family, really.
One thing that's funny is when they're really young, is that when the baby's really small, is the dog has somebody in the house that they're superior to, and they quite like that. And then there's this really funny bit where the kid surpasses them. And I'd say that sort of cognitively and neurologically, that doesn't happen for a couple of years. But then there's a point where the dog has this shameful look on their face, like they've once again become subordinate. They sort of thought, oh yeah, they've just slipped back down the ladder again. But yeah, Seb's great with her. But you also see that funny thing where he tries to be the disciplinarian with her in the same way that me or my wife would. And you just see her look at me and she's like, really? Well, I've got to take orders off this guy.
Did you have dogs when you were growing up, though?
One of the big moments of moving up in our family. So we were doing all right as a family. We were living in, we had our own house, and then we had a divorce. And then my mum took the weird decision to move us to a council flat rather than take him for the house, which was not the feminist thinking of the time, of the 80s. Take him for the house was literally like, that was the main objective of any divorce. She was like, no, I'll leave him with the house and get a little flat. And so we went to the flat. We had loads of cats. We always had loads of cats. But then my mum sort of said, oh, you know, she was on the council list for us. She wanted to get us in a house. She was like, oh, we've got a house. We're like, brilliant. But then she goes, but it's in Mitcham. And Mitcham, if anyone knows it, it's a part of London. It's just... it's really harsh because I know people live there, but put it this way, a McDonald's shut down in Mitcham. When have you ever heard of a McDonald's shutting? Just shut. Just thought this isn't viable. That doesn't happen, right? So, but we had a bit more room and we got our first dog who was Jamie, who I named, but me and my sister argue about that memory now. I'm pretty sure I named him, but he was great. He was an old fashioned, you know, mongrel. You would have to say anyway. I genuinely don't know. Mongrel mutt. I mean, that's maybe a middle ground, isn't it? He was definitely Heinz 57. Used to call him 57 varieties, and he was great. He was brilliant, and that was when I was a teenager. But we still really invested in him, and it seemed to be. We got him very shortly after moving into the house. So it seemed to sort of epitomise a new era. And we had two well-established cats at that time. So he was pretty low in the pecking order. But yeah, again, it was, you know, something else to love. Because my mum and my stepdad were settled, but they were never going to have another kid. But that was the way that we sort of extended the family and bonded over something.
And I want to go back a bit to pre you moving to Mitcham, when you grew up with your mum and your dad in Wimbledon originally, didn't you?
Yeah.
It sounded like a really interesting family life that you had, and it was very sort of lively, wasn't it?
Mm, yeah, my mum and my dad were... So they divorced when I was about 9 and stuff, but my dad was a trade union man. He's a pretty big drinker, but he was like a fun drinker as well, to a point where, you know, there were implications of drinking, but he was... the whole side of that family were like that. My mum was very outspoken, very sharp-minded, but she'd also been left at a convent. I keep going to say that she was an orphan, but she wasn't. Like, her mum was alive, but she was left to be brought up by nuns, which just sounds so historical, doesn't it? But this was the 50s.
So it was you and your sister?
Joanna, yeah, yeah.
And what were you close with her?
Yeah, very close. I mean, one of the things I think is interesting about sibling relationships is that you don't find like loads of great examples of them working well. It's really strange. People kind of grow up in a household of like 3 brothers and sisters, and it's a nightmare. It's an absolute fucking nightmare. And then the moment they get to the point of being married, they go, oh, I definitely want 3. You go, why? They go, well, because that's what I grew up in. Yeah, but you moan constantly and your family are at war You know what I mean? Like every, it's fairly toxic atmosphere. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm sure for a lot of people, maybe they're making out it was worse than it was, maybe. But me and my sister get on well. I mean, she's 18 months older than me. And I wonder if that does work slightly better where you get the kind of nurturing maternal thing where she kept an eye out.
I really was fascinated by your childhood because it struck me that your dad, would you say he was quite a sort of proud man?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think once he, because he had one arm and he had one arm from very early. I could only ever remember him having one arm. And I, to the point where I just sort of thought that was like a thing that happened. I don't know, like with fatherhood, it was like something drops off. Is like, you know, look at all my mates with two-armed dads and be going, might we get a DNA test, mate? So I thought it's the most natural thing in the world that he had one arm. But equally, he never saw himself as disabled. He just sort of refused that definition and never claimed disability benefit and all that. And he just thought that the fact that he could walk meant he wasn't disabled. And you know, you sort of think of, you know, the night in Monty Python getting stuff chopped off. I just always thought, I wonder how dismembered he'd have to be before he sort of conceded that he might need a sort of parking badge, you know, just steadfastly not giving in. And it was really weird because he was like a Labour man. He was a trade union man. And he was always like battling for other people to get, you know, their desserts, you know, from employers and from the state. But he never really wanted any of that for himself.
You talked about how your mum as well was just slightly different to some of the other mums on the estate where you grew up, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, when we moved there, she had standards, you know. Like, this is one of the things people don't realise about a lot of working class communities is how sniffy and proud people can be. Like, within that, so, you know, she's just, I will not have my kids swearing, you know. And so we really stood out. I mean, I say that we lived on a council estate, but within the context of the estate we were on, we were seen as being quite well-to-do because we'd moved there at a certain age. We had wallpaper and a phone, you know, and like having a phone. We were the only people for a long time in our block to have a phone. And we used to mind our P's and Q's around people. So we were considered posh where we lived. So we did get a bit of bullying for that. But the longer my mum lived there, it's fair to say that she did assimilate more into council estate life and the swearing. And you remember, she was like born in the East End and, you know, how she'd grown up. In many ways, she sort of became closer to what she started life as. You know, the bit where she was an aspiring middle-class woman supporting her husband's career, that was less natural to her than sort of just swearing and smoking all day. And
you were quite articulate as well, weren't you? And that was, do you think that was from your mum?
Definitely, yeah. She would always, you know, if I said a word, she would say, do you know what that means? Get the dictionary, make me read it. And I do the same with my son, but it did mean that on the estate, I got this nickname of Long Word Alert, which was
that's like, such a shit nickname.
It's really nickname. It's quite verbose as well, isn't it? That's the problem. Long word. It's like they've used a lot of syllables to accuse me of being long-winded. And, you know, explaining that irony to them is probably why I got punched in the face.
Did you feel, Jeff, when you were growing up, you know, you always have a sense of your class, I suppose, don't you? I remember saying to my mum, what class are we, mum? And she said, we're classless, darling. And when I told the boyfriend that, he said, I think the darling rather gives it away, don't you? I wonder what for you, was there a sense of you thinking, you know, from quite a young age, right, we're a working class family?
So when we were living, my dad, he had a job at BT as a draftsman. We were probably quite middle class at that point, I think, but I didn't know that. And then the first time I became aware of class was we moved to the council estate where they all thought we were posh, which was a tricky irony to negotiate for us as we were on our arse, basically. My dad had just got made redundant. So then we lived there and we were considered posh within that world, right? And then I went to, you know, going to South London Boys Comprehensive, you always get a fair sort of sense of where you fit in the grand scheme of things. And we were, you know, we were certainly, you're never the poorest when you go to a comp, do you know what I mean? There's always somebody who's got things tougher than you. But when I went to Goldsmiths Liberal Arts College to do my degree, that was when I really, and maybe this sort of lifelong antipathy towards the middle classes started there, where I just hadn't researched. Everyone sort of says to me now, is like, that is the most obviously worst place for you to go. And it was just after like Damien Hirst, Blur and all that business. And it was really full of it, you know, really full of itself and Save the Whales and Save fucking Cuba and all these. And when you know like lots of people whose lives are really difficult, and then you see other people who've got the space in their life to save Wales and communist countries miles away, you sort of think, well, that's like a form of privilege. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's good for you that you've got the space to worry about this stuff. And I suddenly, you know, there were little things said to me, and quite often I think those people didn't realise they had sort of class bias and little, like for example, like I remember the first time I heard the word sabbatical, and it was when I was at Goldsmiths, and there was one of the girls, everyone was, all their dads had really nice jobs, and she said, oh yeah, my dad's on sabbatical at the moment. And then when she explained it to me, that if you got to a certain point in your career that you might like have a year off to like learn piano and go to India or something, I just couldn't compute how the fuck. I was thinking, no wonder they live longer.
I had that thing of being the poorest girl at the you know, I know no one's going to cry for me, but the poorest girl at the private school, you know, and that's a point of difference, isn't it?
That's interesting. So you were actually in a like quite a posh thing, but you felt like the poorest girl. I was in a council estate and they thought I was aristocracy. So in our own ways, I think we sort of had similar experiences where we've had to cope with some fairly rich ironies. I remember like I dated this girl around that time, and I remember they just used to have orange juice with their dinner, like just like it was nothing. And my mum had always been very reverential towards orange juice. She used to say like it's pure. When she used to say the word pure orange juice, the word pure made it sound like it was liquid diamonds. And I just had no real concept of the relative value of it because of that. And then you had like people, you had families that had, like I had a mate, James, and his mum used to have real Coke cans in the fridge. And I just thought it was just so extravagant. And we didn't even have like the next two levels of cola down. We had Vogue Cola, and it was like Quicksave's own brand. And it was just brown fizzy water. It was just disgusting. It was genuinely disgusting. And me and my sister tried to sort of like lobby my mum to say it would be better to not to have anything. That's how bad it was, than to have this in our house for when friends came over. And I think she came alive when we were poor, you know, like she loved scrimping and saving. And she used to go between, I don't know if you remember the supermarket wars of the early 90s, where they really go, you had like tins of beans for 3p. So she was like a one woman app where she'd know exactly what was available where on any given day. And she had like, with Mitcham Town Centre, she had like little people that she would go to tell her who had the deals on bread that day and stuff. So, you know, like food shopping was a bigger part of people's expenses back then. And, I did have that aspiration. I wanted to have, like, even now, like I love Diet Coke, right? And I have cans in my fridge. I still get a little buzz off it, just thinking, hey, I can have cans of Diet Coke in my fridge. That's what we're doing, all right.
When did you, Jeff, get the first idea that you were funny?
So when I'm doing that American thing, I'm going, so do you know Adam Buxton on his podcast does this really funny trope of people going, so like Americans always start every sentence with so fuck. I went to do it again though. That's how compelling it is. We were on our holiday as the marriage was sort of going up the shitter basically, and there was one of these save the marriage holidays. We went to Afflefield Bay on the Isle of Wight, and it was both tense but funny. There were funny things happening on the holiday. Like my dad at one point went in a dad's swimming competition fully clothed. He'd had a couple of beers. He just jumped in, one old man, and he won. So like there were these great moments, but it was also the marriage was coming to an end. And I remember I went, they had a best cowboy competition, and I went out and I just kind of was like dressed shambolically. I don't know what a best cowboy competition is, by the way. It was just one of these talent things. Basically, you just put on a Stetson and a holster. And I just made people laugh. And I remember that sound. And I remember, here we go, he's going to get emotional. But for that second, everything felt all right. You know, I remember logging that. It was like, oh, yeah, it's okay. Like I put out a fire, temporarily at least.
Would you have been aware of your parents sort of responding to that and feeling proud as well?
Yeah, I just vaguely remember being in the light and the parent hearing the sound of all the mums and dads laughing. And yeah, I think it just gave everyone a little buzz, you know what I mean? A little lift. And I was interested in jokes, and I used to, my dad did the public speaking, but my mum was the funny one. And this, I find it a lot with comics. People often presume, probably in a sexist way, like it's the dad. But quite often mums are inherently funnier. And my mum was funny. She loved all the like American sitcoms like Cheers and stuff, and mainly Cheers at that time, I think. Oh, there was a Taxi and stuff. But, you know, she got me watching all this stuff. So I had an interest in humour, yeah, and it was mainly cultivated by her.
And when they got divorced, your parents, what sort of impact do you think it has on you as a kid?
Well, the marriage was difficult. And I think for a lot of people, the resolution of that difficulty was a relief, I think, probably for everyone. I think it's certainly, my dad had a renaissance after that. And my mum, you know, she was taken out of that situation. But I remember, like, my mum confided in me that she was going to go for divorce. I do look back and think, that was quite a big bit of information to drop. And I can specifically remember being, oh, this is like a serious thing I'm being told here. And stuff. So she definitely like lent on me and my sister in certain ways, but it makes sense because like she didn't have any family, she didn't have any support network, you know. She'd married into this family, you know what I mean? She'd Meghan Markled it, really, you know. My nan was a bit like the Queen, like a working. My nan was really quite good, you know, solid woman, but she'd lived through the Blitz. She was a bit severe. And there were those sort of tensions there, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, so I know that for some families, like it really messes them up, doesn't it, divorce? But I think it was probably positive on balance for all of us coming out of it.
There's something you say, which I really liked again in your book, about how you came back one time and your mum was wearing a dressing gown in the afternoon. And again, I so related to that, Jeff. I'd get back and I'd feel a real sense of anger about it. I think, yeah, I mean, life together. What is that? Just kids being judgmental, do you think?
It is. I think for me, the aesthetic of it, and I didn't have a word for it then, but it just looked feckless. It looked like really like wasting your day. And it was definitely the first stirring of like small C conservatism, whereby, you know, I was 10 or so at the time. I was thinking, for God's sake, woman, put on some bloody clothes and just get out there and just do something with your day. And I mean, where did I get off, right? Like thinking that. But I would say that, you know, I've spoken about this with audiences sometimes, that dressing gown thing is pretty common. And I'll go further and say that when you see people standing outside a hospital in a dressing gown smoking, I defy anybody not to become a bit more right wing and judgmental, right? You just come out and you go, I don't know what it is. It's such a fuck you to the idea of trying to be healthier, which is mainly what a hospital is there, to improve your health. And it's just, I don't know what it is about smoking. It really bugs me. It's partly that absent-minded look they get on their face while they're smoking. I don't know what that is. Obviously, they're buzzing a little bit or something, but maybe I'm a bit jealous. And also, I think with smoking, like, you know, there's a lot of addictions, but there's very few where people sort of think, oh, I'm just going to do this 20 times a day. There's very few like that. I'm just going to do this all day at regular intervals, the whole day. And you think, that is quite greedy.
I've got a really vivid impression of you as a kid. And you strike me, again, from reading your brilliant book, but you just came across, or you come across in the book, as this kid who's just really, quite mature and quite like a mini man in a way.
Yeah, I think probably I have been, you know, like that, being quite conscientious, and in social situations I would often, you know, when everyone else, certainly when you're a teenager, everyone's going a bit nuts, I would have one eye on kind of like jeopardy and potential risky outcomes. You know, I definitely have a catastrophizing thing in me, but also the only way I get past that is by occasionally binge drinking. So that is the one time when I can sort of throw off all those shackles, but then I can't remember it, so that's no good. People say, oh, you seem so free and so liberated. And I go, yeah, that's, I don't remember anything. And all I have is shame now.
I was interested as well, because you went to John Major's school.
Well, at the time, I thought a mini election there as a Lib Dem, but there was, you know, certainly in working class circles at that time, the idea was prevalent that the Conservatives, it just didn't seem like anything that would accommodate somebody like me. But it was a real big challenge to that, was that I think they even had a poster that said, what would the Conservatives do with a working class kid from Brixton, where they made him prime minister? And so I didn't in any way see myself as Conservative at that time. I think my mum would have fucking thrown me out if I'd have said anything like that. But I was just like, well, I couldn't take refuge in some of the cliches that you get about politics. I was going, well, I've got a really good example of when that wasn't the case. Now, I'm sure that, you know, people are very left-wing listening to this. They'll think, well, that's only because he was a traitor. Now, there's always an argument. Well, no, he forgot, he wasn't really working class. But, you know, he did have quite a modest start in life and he did become prime minister. You know, and a lot of time it gets underestimated. We talk about a phenomenon of working class Conservative support now, like so many things, like environmentalism or race issues or feminism. We go, oh, this is all happening now for the first time. I remember these debates in a circular way going back a long way. And I remember, you know, the 1992 general election, they were saying it's going to be swung by a Mondeo man, right? You know, the guy that moved out to, you know, the home counties because he wanted a bigger garden and maybe a Jaguar, right? You know, eventually, but a Mondeo for now. And I do think sometimes that maybe that's what I am, really, is Mondeo man. I'm like, Mondeo man, you know, that's my origin story anyway, was that it's not a shameful thing to just think, yeah, I'd like a nice house and a few nice holidays. And, you know, that is the objective for a hell of a lot of people in this country, is to just gently improve your situation. That's, you know, just do some nice stuff, nice things. You know, and they often talk about like billionaires and stuff like that. I think I often view them as just mentally a bit unwell. You know, I view that as like a weird kind of mutation of capitalism, that you need a few of them at one end, but really in the middle, that's what most people want. If you give people peace, I'm not getting political, but if you give people peace and prosperity, you'll probably do all right.
Did you, when you went to Goldsmiths then, Jeff, which is obviously that, you must have been incredibly bright because you got 3 A's for your A-levels, which is why you were able to go there.
Yeah, I did all right. I would say I think I had a day out, if you know what I mean. You know, like, I don't think I was a 3A. I think I was capable of good critical thought and stuff like that. But because my mum had become disabled around that time, my revision was really focused because I had a lot on at home. And I remember just doing the exams and going, this is exactly what I revised, like time and time again.
You must have been bright though, Jeff.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But I just think my 3 A's was so far. But I remember at the time they were like, oh, you should pull out and try and go to Oxford or Cambridge. But I just sort of knew that that wasn't a good move for me. I didn't know what I'd do in the meantime. Because, you know, it's a very middle class thing going, oh, I'll go to Maku Piku or whatever the fuck it is people do for a year. And that's just not, you know... I might have, got, I don't know, I've been a sort of club rep or something for a year, but I didn't have any idea of what would feel that year. Weirdly, this shows like the need to work mentality that a lot of my family have always had. Is my biggest issue with that is, what will I do in the year? You know, what will I do without an objective? That was what worried me more than anything in terms of, because there were some teachers that I had, mainly the female teachers that were very optimistic and nice, going, pull out, go to Oxford, Cambridge, you can do it. And then I remember some of the male teachers like, no, maybe you should just crack on, you know.
How would you describe that culture that was at Goldsmiths when you were there?
Well, firstly, I was really happy at the school I was at, sixth form college there. I liked it. It had good friends there. So I started again. And I can remember I went there with one lad who was a good friend of mine, really lovely bloke. And he'd been, you know, one of those kind of middle of the road kind of characters at sixth form. Everyone loved him. Suddenly, he was like really popular. And I just couldn't get my head around it. And I just did not seem to fit in. I was very direct. You know what I mean? I was very overtly blokey. And, you know, as a college that was very liberal and probably maybe 2/3 female, very feminist, I just was like, oh my God, you know, like I really thought that I would go there and it would be constant women. And I don't think I got off with anybody at university. And I'd had a reasonable track record up till that point, but it all came to a grinding. I was just not in fashion. The kind of bloke I was wasn't fashionable. You know, it was the new man at the time, and all this stuff that me and my mates from around the way had thought was a bit of a joke, you know, blokes in cardigans talking about feelings. Suddenly, they were the ones getting all the women. And I was, it took me a long time to kind of work out what was going on. And I'd stayed at home and I was commuting as well.
My sister would always say, never date a poet, they dump you on your birthday. And there is that thing though, isn't there?
Yeah. There was something a bit disingenuous about those guys as well. It was like all they were was smart enough to work out what the new way of getting somewhere was, right? Like when it came down to it, I felt like they were no less arrogant or conceited or egotistical. And you often find, I mean, as you know, like, you know, you're a woman working in the entertainment industry, the gulf between stated values in terms of gender politics and actual way that men are, there can sometimes be a chasm.
Yeah.
And so I was just a bit more just direct, I suppose. I mean, it's not like wolf whistling and pinching asses or anything like that, but just, you know, I just was coming from a much more working class environment when it comes to dating and asking people out and how you were around women.
And tell me, Jeff, how you ended up going into stand-up and getting into comedy. What happened?
I met my wife and then I had three career changes in the first like 2 years of being with her. But we met on a night out, put it that way, and I was like immediately like, oh, I won the jackpot here, you know. And it was just a case of not trying to be so desperate that I ruined it, but I did propose within 6 months, you know. It was so obvious to me. Like, I was like, yeah, I need to get a long-term contract here. But, you know, when you know, this is an old-fashioned idea, but there is this idea, I suppose, with men, that you've got to do slightly better for yourself than you deserve, right? It's the reason sitcom couples, the woman's always slightly nicer looking, you know, like... Because you can sort of say to the bloke, well, you've done all right for yourself. You can't really say that to the woman. That's really rude. I mean, it does work. But I mean, you sort of think it can't work for everybody because there's a scale where that starts to not work. And I think that's where wealth and power come in and maybe correct things a little bit. But yeah, I just knew very quickly. I mean, we've been together 18 years now, since we're 2002. So getting on for 19 years.
You were telling me how you first got into comedy.
Yeah, so there was a mate of mine from university. We used to sit during lectures and try and make each other laugh by sort of writing weird facts about D.H. Lawrence and stuff. You know, so we just used to find each other funny. We were so immature, we actually got told off in lectures, which is really embarrassing when you're like 19. But we created a double act. It's going to sound really, this, it sounds like something a middle-class sort of performer would do. We created a double act called the Bubka Brothers, which were two Russian dissidents who were hiding in the UK, but they were sort of doing a bit of stand-up just to get by, and they would do death-defying feats, but they weren't that impressive, you know, like they were just very, it was just a way of being on stage and stuff. And he was like, he's so funny, such an intelligent guy. But it wasn't really for him, and we had these bookings in the diary, and I just thought, I also needed a bit of extra cash because when I started being a teacher, I was skint, you know, and I thought I'll just do the gigs with sort of casual. I'll just come up with some funny stuff. And it took a long time for me to get any good at all. And like everything, I've always sort of thought of myself as, you know, a bit talented and stuff. But actually, all the evidence suggests it takes me ages to sort out what I'm doing and become any good at it.
Because you initially became a teacher, didn't you?
Yeah, so I was working in advertising, but in advertising sales, I'd started doing a little bit of stand-up. But I sort of thought I'd need to put this good a degree in English, and I had three A's, but I was really doing nothing. So I thought I'd retrain, because they were offering like a training salary at that time, but I'd retrain to be a teacher. But I'd only done that for a few years when a comedy agent asked to sign me. So then I kind of did them side by side for a while, and then did quite a lot of supply teaching, because you could do Monday to Wednesday supply teaching and then Thursday to Saturday gigging.
Were you quite a strict teacher, Jeff?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, again, you talk about awakenings of conservative mindsets. It's like, I thought I'd be like, hey, guy, you know, just, you know, pick your own tasks. And I was like, yeah, I suddenly realised that teenagers are very superficial. And I know that in modern teaching, you're supposed to go, no, they're not, Jeff. They're not. They're the basic little bitches, most of them. They're really easily led as well, especially the boys, right? So just wear a suit. You know what I mean? Look smart, wear a tie, start the lessons properly, insist on them saying like, yes, sir, rather than, like when you do the register, and they go, huh, you know what I mean? They're just trying to immediately assert that they're casual and that they don't give a shit. So I was always like, no matter how long it took, I'd be like, yes, sir. Like that, you have to say, yes, I loved being called sir. Weirdly, like even the female senior teachers, like we had a female head teacher at one school, and she'd come in and she'd go, excuse me, sir. And I think, yeah. Damn right, sir. I don't know why you have to call me sir, but it's a perk of the job. And I was pretty, you know, strict and I really clamped down hard on disrespect because I also often thought, like, you pull at that thread, man. Once one of them's called you a villain, like, you know, you villain, sir, like, that's it. The wall is crumbling. You've got to, it's straight red card. Off you go, son.
And they're like dogs, teenagers. They smell fear.
Completely, and they act as a pack. And the boys were like, I don't know if you know like Star Wars, but you know they say like, oh, the sand people are easily spooked, but they will return in greater numbers. Boys were a bit like that. Teenage girls, it was much more delicate process. I found that a bit terrifying at times because they were sort of like superheroes who'd discovered this superpower, which was manipulation, but yet they hadn't harnessed the strength of it. I know that's like weird, that sounds really sexist, but my God, man, if you're faced out, you know, and I taught at a few girls' schools, like 30 teenage girls all cricking their necks. You know that thing that girls do when they're like, mm-hmm? You're like, fucking hell. Like, they are so, in that respect, so far ahead of the boys. It's like, it's really hard to maintain the old, hey, gender's a construct, man, once you've been a parent or a teacher.
You started getting into comedy. And it interests me that you did it whilst you were still teaching because you needed to support yourself.
There used to be a really thriving club circuit late 90s through to the mid 90s where you could earn good money. Like you could earn, like if you were a busy comic doing the odd corporate, you could earn as much as like a deputy head teacher just through gigging, right? So that was quite friendly to working class mindsets, is that it was an honest day's labour. Well, on it, that's the 20 minutes. A lot of it was just spending in hotels masturbating yourself into another dimension. But there was end product, you did your job, you got paid. And then you start hearing about this thing called the Edinburgh Festival, right? And then you start hearing about 5-year plans. And then you start speaking, like the first time I did it, I was just like, I'm going to do the gigs, get as many people in. I was like, maybe I could turn up, you know, make a few quid. I honestly thought I could make money. And then people are like, yeah, no, I'm probably going to lose 12 grand in year one. You know, like a really sort of bad Dragon's Den pitch, 5 grand a year too. And they had, I was like, where are you getting this long game for? Like, just the simple idea of losing money at any point just didn't compute with me. Now, as I've gone on, I've got my head around it more about making investments of time. But again, it was just with your background. I was like, no, you can't lose money. I was like, you're doing the Edinburgh Festival. I earned 6 grand in August. You know, and they're like, yeah, but where's it going, Jeff? I'm like, 6 grand. They're like, what if the club circuit disappears? I'm like, 6 grand. Couldn't get over it. You know, I was thinking, you idiots are up there at the Edinburgh Festival. I'm clearing up all your work, mate. Yeah. But turns out, you know, and also at the Edinburgh Festival, there was a lot of kind of very introspective, kind of kooky performers, you know, beta males. I was like, yeah, since when is this ever going to be popular on telly, eh? Nice try, lads.
Was that sort of slightly later that your comedy became more known for being regularly political?
Yeah, it was 2013. I mean, I'd done the club circuit. I felt like I knew what I was doing there, but also felt a bit creatively stale. And I'd voted Conservative at the 2010 election and then like a couple of local elections. And my wife was just like, that's weird, isn't it, for a comic? That's a weird thing to talk about. And then the Leicester Comedy Festival was coming up. And I thought, I'll just do a bit of the show trying to talk about that. And I immediately, like, once I started talking about it, I had the nerves back, you know, because I knew it was a bit of a, I mean, also, a lot of people seem to think that I just started talking about politics, like, conveniently when Brexit happened. But the truth was, I was doing it for a while. I was just really shit at it. And it took me a long time. No one cared. Like, no one cared. Early 2013 through to 2017, I was just trying to learn how to do comedy again, but in a way that potentially made me unpopular in the room, which was always my biggest fear. Of course, we know now that there are a lot of closet conservatives, but at least people would present as like, what's he saying here? How voting in line with 42% of the countries is scandalous. But I sort of got off on it. It was like a tricky, you know, in golf, like you get a par five, like a tricky par five. I thought I'd made comedy harder again. And, you know, I've been making it harder ever since.
You've said yourself that the comedy world is predominantly left-leaning, isn't it?
Yeah.
And indeed, most of the sort of performing world and the arts, it's very much sort of, most people's politics do tend to, you know, be of the left persuasion.
Yeah.
It feels quite a bold thing to do.
It didn't, I mean, if I'm honest, I'd like to think it was really courageous, but at that time it was the coalition era and politics wasn't quite as spiky as it is now. And the real time when it first felt like it had proper purchase was in 2015. I don't know if you remember that election where social media for the first time, everyone thought this obviously sort of statesman-like figure of Ed Miliband, prime ministerial, powerful, now, obviously he was going to win, right? With politicians, you know, people talk about Miliband with the bacon sandwich and they talk about Kinnock. A lot of people, and this is quite well established throughout civilizations, is when you look at leaders, it's an instinctive thing, right? Mm. How do they make me feel? And I suggest that the bacon sandwich moment with Miliband was more of a metaphor for something people already felt. I don't believe that the British public literally saw one photo of a guy doing whatever it was he was doing in that sandwich and just went, no, I'm going to vote differently. I think that they just felt at that point that Cameron was more prime ministerial, you know. And certainly I remember like all my stand-up colleagues and stuff, they just confidently presumed that Labour would win in 2015. And then we sort of saw the start of the spikiness, which kind of carried on and, you know, got a lot bigger during Brexit and kind of carried on for quite a long time since. Because people tend to have like a bunch of opinions that go hand in hand, but it doesn't really make any sense, right? So like, if you vote Brexit, you've got to be anti-Meghan Markle. You know, it's really odd, you know, like, and you've got to be a bit suspicious about climate change. Like, no, I fucking don't. You know, I voted to leave the institution that was the EU. I don't want to have all this out of a kind of composite personality. So I'm definitely approaching things on more of a play-by-play basis. And you know, like, I don't care how conservative you are. I think that I'm naturally a conservative voter. There are certain things about me, and probably if people think that, what, that you're a selfish bastard that hates paying taxes, probably. But I will always be a conservative voter, mostly, right? But like, you can't look at the conservatives over this last year and not think of jokes and have criticisms and just wonder how Gavin Williamson is. Just amazing that he's still in a job, and it's been quite liberating. I'll probably, like, my bias will always come out, I think, probably. But why would you deny yourself a joke, you know, just because you saw yourself as batting for one team? I don't feel that as much anymore. I think I'm more of like a right-wing centrist dad is what I am, you know. I'm just, whatever centrism is, I'm just a bit to the right of that. I wanted to think I was radical, but then we had a pandemic and I had my opportunity to be with, you know, the real kind of keep everything open people. And I sort of hesitated a bit. So maybe my libertarian thing isn't quite as strong as I thought. The problem is with social media, whereas if people are heavily Remain or heavily Labour, they can make very negative presumptions about you as a person. So if you tweet something lightheartedly, just go off to get a cup of tea, and then it's so incredible to realise the sort of malicious intent that they often perceive behind it, because they sort of read it with whatever anger they've got in their head. And I don't really get angry about that stuff, you know. I become motivated to talk about it, become invigorated by it, but I rarely get angry. I'd actually say that my incapacity for anger is one of my biggest character flaws. It's weird, it's freakish.
Is it really?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I look at some of the things that have happened in my life, like, you know, like yourself, I've you know, quite a lot of loss around a certain point, both parents, best mate, stepdad, And we also, we had a stillbirth at like quite a late stage. All of that happened in a very short space of time. And then I sometimes think I should be smashing some shit up at some point soon. You know, you think it would probably be healthy for me to get angry. But I think when you've got a rational mindset, it's hard to locate that sometimes. And you look at those people. I read somewhere that the people that verbally and vocally express anger regularly, actually, it's actually good for them physically. I got so jealous. I thought, those pricks, they get to be arseholes. Do a bit of road rage and they actually benefit from that, whereas I would tend to internalise it.
How do you cope with the situations that you're talking about? What are your coping mechanisms for stuff like that?
Well, I suppose what was interesting, particularly after losing my mum, is that I had to go against type, like the kind of bloke I was. I was like, I just want to feel better. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the one good thing about me is whatever I think I am, if I like to feel, I don't like feeling sort of anxious. You know, I have problems with anxiety and stuff. So I was like, all right, what can I do? So I like did acupuncture. I thought I'd give meditating a go. Although I've sacked that off recently. I just can't do it. It's too boring. It just, you go like, and they're always the same, aren't they? This meditation, they're always going like fucking, whatever you're thinking is okay, but stop thinking it now. So it doesn't matter if it comes back, but if it does, you're not doing it right. It winds me up. And then like counselling, you know, counselling, I mean, that just makes sense. And I've often sold it to some of my more blokey mates as just like, if you ever want to convince a bloke to do counselling, right, like a real man's man, is tell him that the American military use it. They always go, really? You're like, yeah, the American military have realised that talking therapies are create better warriors. And they go, well, yeah, might do a bit then. Because a lot of blokes just perceive that whatever the American military do makes sense. And yeah, I've found those a lot of value. But I always think with some counsellors, you do run to a point where you go, they're just, you know, it's just a pity party, isn't it, after a while.
You've been through a hell of a lot, and I think you look back on it though and you do feel changed. Why do you think that the sort of grief and going through those difficult experiences just makes you a bit more rounded as a person?
I mean, there's a limit, you know, where you sort of feel, all right, okay, these things have happened and I've managed to sort myself out. I do think that I have a tolerance limit, and that's maybe sometimes where the fear comes from. You think all those bad things happen, what if some more happened? You know what I mean? You go, I don't know how I fucking cope, really. So I think the anxiety comes from that. Me and my mate that I did the double act with, we always used to laugh over the phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. We always used to try and reword it to like, what doesn't kill you damages you irrevocably, but ultimately you've just got to get on with it, really.
What doesn't kill you leaves you with 10% brain function.
Yeah, what doesn't kill just gouges you on a daily basis and comes around like a comet and destroys your landscape periodically, but it'll probably be all right. I do think in a weird way that has impacted my politics, because people would be, you know, it's like when you go online and people go, oh my God, this is outrageous, or they say, I'm exhausted from tweeting about this. You go, no one's exhausted from tweeting, all right? Like, and they'll make out something that's happened in the public eyes, this great personal calamity. And I do often think, look, when something really bad happens in your life, you're going to know about it. Right, and you're not going to want to tweet about it, for one. And I definitely, particularly around 2015, 16, developed a bit of a very tin ear for pathos. You know, I was just like, because I had to believe that you got to sort yourself out, because that was all I had available to me. You know, it was personal responsibility. So it became a bit of a religion for me, the idea that the individual and the individual alone has the power to improve their, you know, situation. Wasn't really that up for hearing victim narratives, because I always thought, well, I understand the narrative, but the problem with victim narratives is you're never the one with the power to change it. You know, the time that you spend moaning about what's happened to you is time you could spend making it better. So I think maybe I'm a little bit more chilled out now, but around the time of those things happening, I had to become a little bit more militant in my own sort of small P political view just to crack on.
And you're touring, because obviously in lockdown that hasn't been an option, but yeah. I blame the parents. Is that starting
September?
September.
Yeah, so no doubt we'll all have our COVID certification status forms, which definitely aren't passports, by the way. just a lot more syllables, and they have photos on them and way more information than a passport, but it's a certificate. So certificates are cool, right? Yeah, but it's happening. It's happening in September, and I've been able to, through Zoom gigs and various things, build up quite a lot of material. And I love the phrase, I blame the parents, because I sort of thought, what's one of those phrases that is essentially conservative with a small c, but I think people on both sides of the political divide would have found themselves saying, you know, as I blame the parents. And you, ultimately, you can always do that. And I think, you know, it would definitely be, I mean, I'm constantly retelling my parents' story, you know, it's an endless fascination to me. And I think that they'll always form a component of whatever show I do, but they would always be probably the same mix. About a third of it will be about my family, a third will be about politics and social commentary, and then a third of it will probably just be observational humour, you know, and you know, I'll talk about the difference between men and women, because I know it's supposed to be like a cliched subject, but it's a constant source of fascination to me. Women drinking and the way that they always get support from her mates, and she'll say, oh, 1 o'clock is wine o'clock, and her mates go, yeah, you drink that wine, Claire, you drink it, you deserve it. When did this happen whereby women are sort of celebrating each other's descent into alcoholism? And I think it's really quite, one of my mates, she does ones where she's drinking in the bath and her friends are like, you know, party poppers and flamenco lady emojis. And I'm sort of thinking, if that was a man, like drinking in the bath would be seen as one of the end games of like rabid alcoholism. But for some reason, it's women, it's fun, it's fine.
Sitting there with a bottle of scotch.
It's really weird. Same with, I think, similar, is female objectification of men. Obviously, men, understandably, we've had to tone it down a bit. It still happens on WhatsApp groups, but, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest link in terms of that getting out. But women have gone really public with just, like, perving over blokes now. They're just, oh, God, look, you know, and they're really defiant about it. And you sort of think, do you know it's possible for women to look creepy as well? I think this is going to be a real awakening for women when they're commenting on the buns of like a 20-year-old waiter, you know, while they're sipping Prosecco with their middle-class maids. You go, you're starting to look a bit Sid James yourself there, lady.
Tell me also about your podcast, Jeff, because you have to tell me, I love your podcast. It's so great.
Oh, thank you. So I started doing it, and this is another thing where I get accused of bandwagon jumping, but I started doing it in about February 2019. I can't actually remember why. I genuinely can't. I just started doing it. It took a while to get it together, and it's called What Most People Think. And I just thought, you know, there's a lot of talk at the time about, you know, liberal bubbles and certain viewpoints not getting airplay within the comedy sort of industry. And despite people thinking I get booked on everything, I really don't, you know. I get, you know, I'm lucky enough to get some, you know, sort of TV gigs, but it's not wall to wall. So I sort of thought this would be a bi-weekly thing that I would do and take on certain subjects. And then the pandemic happened. I thought, well, it's a topical podcast. Really, it should be weekly. And that's what I try to do, is, you know, take on a subject and just try and come to like what I think is a reasonable middle ground, normal person take on what's happening. But it must be said that, you know, during the pandemic, I've found myself for the first time, you know, when you look at how pro the British public are about vaccine passports and basically living in giant hamster balls for the rest of our lives, it's been one time I've had to really concede this is what I think isn't what most people think. Most people are very pro that, but yeah, I enjoy doing it, and like yourself, probably just that total creative control thing. Like I can say something that's a bit dodgy maybe, or something that I know is a bit controversial, but what I like about podcasts, if I was to tweet that, I could be trending, you know, oh, look what this so-called right-wing comedian said. But if you listen to what I've said and the way I've said it, you'd have to at least deliberately ignore the tone with which I've said it, which is almost always playful, provocative, you know. I'm not, so that's what I love about a podcast, total creative control, and people have to, they can hear my tone, you know, when they listen to it.
But also you'll sometimes have guests on, which I like as well. I love the David Baddiel episode, is one of my favorites, which was the 50th anniversary. I suppose he would have been, David and Frank, they would have been quite sort of high profile at the time. You were sort of thinking, yes, about getting into comedy.
Well, during Britpop and all that period, and also, you know, they were playing to a mass audience. You know, Frank Skinner's got great mainstream, and not like in a negative way, both of them do, the way who they play to, and they're trying to do accessible comedies. I remember when they both kind of came through, it was kind of exciting because there was a lot of that indie type comedy, surreal comedy of the early 90s, but they were two people that I felt spoke directly, you know, to me. And in terms of having people like that on the guest, that was, that to me was, you know, people say it was really surreal. They always say that. People say surreal when they deal with someone. It's so surreal when they deal with someone famous. But it was a bit unusual, you know, this voice of my kind of like teens. And yeah, we've had, you know, everyone on from Owen Jones, you know, to Lawrence Fox. I sort of just reserved the right to think, if I feel like I can have a constructive and or lighthearted conversation, I'll chat with people. You know, I've had Marcus Brigstock on, you know, very funny comic, very, very Romani. I've had people, you know, there's, I sort of have a cast of kind of, not non-woke comics, but, you know, like our little gang on, they come on quite regularly.
I love the idea of being very Romani, because it seems, that does interest me, that idea that there's a certain type of middle-class person.
I think, you know, a lot of it is projection from me. You know, like I sort of have these middle class aspirations. My family always have. We've always been trying to get to the promised land, but then something fucks up and we end up sliding back down again. But yeah, I never tried an olive until I was in my mid-20s or something, you know, but I really liked it. This is the thing, is I take the piss out of middle class people, but they know their food. Like, if you have to give them credit, whatever the food is, like whatever, you know, like everything that's on the Tesco lunch thing now, whether it's, I don't know, sweet potato wedges, middle class people were eating that 5 years ago. And you have to give them credit for being ahead of the curve of what's going to be that next thing, like little falafel bites. They've moved on. If I'm eating Tesco falafel bites, middle class people, they're eating some mad shit. Do you know what I mean? Like mushroom proteins, or I don't know, I don't made out. But I mean, I think middle class people, I feel bad now, because I think they've become really self-conscious about it. It's not a class that anyone wants to be. People don't like people, middle class people like everything. They're always really sorry about it. Like, I'm so sorry for being what I am, you know. And I think you just front it out. Middle class people as well, I do think they're very self-flagellating. That's one thing I'm not. If I enjoy something, I just enjoy it. It doesn't need to be a guilty pleasure, you know, so everyone still knows I'm an intellectual. I just like science fiction films about robots hitting each other, right? I don't need to make an excuse for that.
You strike me as a really direct person. Are you quite direct with your friends and family? Are you known as someone amongst your friendship group that would sort of tell it like it is?
Well, since as you said that, I just realised with my family, we've always been direct. I've always loved that. We just, you know, where our heads at, what's going on. But when I think about my friends, I think I've probably picked them for that reason, that you can just insult them or just tell them exactly where your head's at. And I do think, like, that code, you know, I speak a lot about this doing, like, the BBC diversity panel thing, which I was there to talk about class. But when you go into those very middle-class workplaces, I just feel this simmering tension that everyone, no one's being direct. I don't feel like anyone's even talking to each other, whereas where you get imposter syndrome is where you're having to check certain impulses to just talk or swear or be your normal self. So I really value that. And that's not, I mean, I say it's a working class characteristic. I'm guilty of romanticising it to a point. But just anyone that's willing to be honest about the experience of life, I've always been drawn to people like that.
And you're good friends with Catherine Ryan, and I am as well. And I love that about her.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely with Kath, I'll definitely bond to that, and like it mixed with like a searing wit and wisdom. So like, not only do you get the directness, but she just says, you know, and that's why people laugh, isn't it? Because that's what a comic does at their best, is that they get that truth that was just on the tip of your mind that you could never have got to on your own, and they just say the thing, right? Say the thing that you're not supposed to say, or that, you know, people in their everyday lives wouldn't come across. And I think she's such a great comic, because also the scope of things that she talks about as well is so wide.
I noticed something with Catherine as well, that when I was going through a sort of tough time, she just kept texting me saying, "What's going on, doll? Where are you? What's going on?" And eventually I just thought, oh no, she's going to have to see the tears. She's going to have to see me looking at her. And you know, she was so amazing, Jeff.
We took totally the different things. Like, I literally, after one of the big terrible things that happened, I just texted her and told her in very blunt terms what had happened. And she was like, and to this day, she's one of the few people I spoke to in the immediate aftermath of losing the baby, like just directly about it. And she's a sort of emotionally brave person. And I think I really value that. My mum was like that as well, you know. I think like emotional bravery, because a lot of people aren't, you know, everything all right? You know, when people pose to you a statement question, but they sort of like something bad happens, they go, you're all right? And they nod as they're asking you, you're all right? It's not even a question, mate. You're nodding and saying, you're all right. You're telling me what you want me to be. And look, I love being a bloke, but there are certain times where you go, this is the worst bit of being a bloke, where I know that certain mates of mine just aren't equipped to deal with that, you know, and luckily I have people around me like Kaf that I could have that chat. But yeah, it's really weird how quickly people think you can move on as well. You know, I remember my dad as well, after my mum had gone, he goes, it was like I was having counselling, and it was about 18 months later. He said, are you still having counselling? I went, well, she's still dead. Unless you've got an answer to that, I think I was just going to stick with the counselling. He was just like, well, you're still stuck on that, are you, son? What, this new reality that the rest of my life will be without my mother? Yeah, I'm still kind of like calculating that, Dad, you know.
Yeah, people, I remember someone saying to me, it was after I'd lost my sister and my mum and my dad, and, you know, it was like Game of Thrones. It was just a big body count, you know.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
It was like Red Wedding. It was like, you know what, I thought there was like a showrunner. This is shit TV, like space it out, guys.
You know that feeling, like, is anyone more dad that knew me that I would get a knock from the old Bill? Because I've sort of thought, if they don't at least ask me some questions, they're not really doing their job.
I said at one point that I was getting embarrassed. It sounds crazy, of telling friends.
I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
And I said, I imagined them saying like that Brenda from Bristol, oh, another one?
No, I know exactly what you mean, because after I'd had, you know, both parents, best friend, baby, and then my stepdad like a year later, and I felt like at that point I was taking the piss. So there were some people I didn't tell initially about my stepdad, who'd been in my life since I was 9. So I thought, oh, it just seems a bit far-fetched. I mean, there are loads of shit metaphors about grief, like, and you always have to make out like all of them are worthy, don't you? I go, oh, that's a beautiful way. That's a really beautiful way of seeing it. And some of them aren't. But I do think sort of it's a bit like a comet, you know, like, so it doesn't come around as often, not always, but when it does, it's like it's burning hard and fucking firing into your atmosphere, and you go, shit, like, this comet is always here, but then it does, oh God, I'm hating my own metaphor at this point. What I'm saying is when it's bad, it often feels as bad as it ever was. It's just a question of how often it's bad these days.
Yeah.
That's what changes.
Jeff, I want to talk, I know we've talked about it a lot in this podcast, but I just want to formally introduce it before we go, which is your fabulous book, which is, honestly, you are such a brilliant writer.
Thank you. You see how my jaw clenched when I said thank you then, because I didn't know how to deal with the compliment. Like, it's so nice to hear. I thought...
Do you find compliments quite difficult to take?
Well, I just don't know how to say it, but also it's a new compliment for me as well, because I've never written a book before. So I'm sort of working out how I react to that. When, just, you know, your stock response, like when you come stand up, people go, oh, great gig, oh, yeah, cheers. But there's a way, whereas author, I've got to have a new way of accepting the praise. I'll be like, thank you very much. And just bow. One thing I did find was, the main thing I wanted to do, you know, when you write like people write, that's a real danger. Of going, right, how does it, same whenever I do an article, I go, you've just written like a journalist. That's the last thing I want to do. And that was the thing I was writing a book, was you can't avoid that to a point. There are certain, I just wanted it to sound a bit like me as well, because I remember there's a few early chapters where I thought, who is writing this? It sounds like I've employed a shit ghostwriter, you know? So it was almost like de-wording it. I went through the opposite. I was like, make it sound more basic. The point was like, I sort of thought, I'm not like massively well known as a comic, you know, like I'm known enough, but I thought if I'm going to do a book, I've got to offer, I'm not like famous to the point where people will just go, what was he like at school? No one's thinking that. No one gives a shit. I was like, I've got to tell a story. And I thought, well, what I can tell is, like, people often would say to me, how the hell did you end up being right wing or conservative? I thought, well, there's a way of, and then I thought, well, what about all the sort of totemic political events of my lifetime, but like from a worm's eye view? And using that, I can tell the story of my mum and dad and everything. And really, I mean, you probably already guessed reading it. It really is mostly about them in a way. And I thought, yeah, and it does get like a tad more political as it goes on. But I saw, yeah, all those weird things like the credit crunch, you know, like the expenses scandal, like Brexit, you know, just tell that story from an every person perspective and how each thing changed me. And being a teacher during a time when trendy teaching and quite sort of touchy-feely teaching methods were being deployed and how that affected me. And yeah, I was pleased with it at the end, you know, like sort of wrapping it up and realising that it was partly, a lot of it was about my dad, to be honest. You know, and that surprised me as I was writing it, because my mum was a huge figure in my life. But evidently at that point, God, this, I sound like a wanker now. This is the problem, is I'm heckling myself in my own head. This is the problem, I'm going, you wanker. Like, all my mates from GCSE science that I sat with going, shut up, you mug, why are you talking about this? Really, it's actually about my dad. It's about I think a lot of things, but just like comedy, I have to keep several different plates spinning, you know, to keep it interesting.
I reckon your parents would be really proud of you, Jeff, if they read that book.
Stop it, you're gonna make me go I'm not gonna get emotional. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, like, you hope you've done them justice in the stories, because I think that with me and my sister's a brilliant chronicler of like things and trinkets and house, you know, she's like a real family custodian of that. I like to think that, like, some of the stories that they're my thing to look after, because there's some brilliant, you know, some of the stuff they said, did people would, like, do you remember there was that period with comedians where young comedians in skinny jeans would say outrageous things that their parents had done, and you think, well, I don't really believe that your parents did that, but fucking whatever, okay, let's do it. But my problem was that no one believed them and they were true, you know, so I often wouldn't tell them. But I think in terms of a story, there was a bit more scope to tease those things out. Like, I mean, one of the stories that no one ever believes is that my mum, when I felt that I was getting victimised by a teacher, so she comes up to school and she jumps out, and then Miss Reed is having a pop at me, and I might even have deserved it, but my mum has basically embedded herself in a cupboard, well, in a partition between the two classrooms, like some mad sniper woman. And yeah, but the people just don't, and she jumped out and basically accosted the teacher, but people just don't believe that happened. It just sounds too ridiculous. And the thing about true stories like that is just, they don't have a payoff. So I'm never going to lie and put in a punchline and da-da. Mm. You just have to tell the story. So I enjoyed getting those together and, you know, getting them down for posterity.
I felt that your mum, if she'd have been born into a different time, would have been a CEO or running a company. Or...
She's a battle axe. You know what I mean? She would have called herself that, but in the best possible, you know, those old kind of South London matriarchs, right? She was a really powerful, smart person. I think, you know, one of the things when the sort of welfare was expanding and people were getting more paid, more money for disability and incapacity, one thing I found difficult about that was that they made it, like, not profitable for my mum to go back to work after she became disabled. You know, she was, it was almost, it felt like hush money to me, you know? So that was one, I suppose, a regret that I had for her on her behalf, was that exactly as you say, she was formidable. That's the word, formidable, which is a polite way of saying battle axe.
And what word would you use to sum up your dad?
I don't know. The word that comes into my mind is mad, but I don't mean that. actually, at his funeral, the word that I said was difficult. And you know those funerals where everyone just either describes a person that never lived. And I was sort of there and I thought, I can't lie about him. He's great. I loved him a bit, you know. But I said, my dad was a difficult man, and the congregation all sort of like moved and relaxed a little bit. But I think, like, you know, the thing about difficult people that you stay in touch with, it means they've got something really great about them, because they're able to get away with being difficult. I mean, like, those choices are so important. With my mum, we played Feeling Hot, 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 because she was getting cremated. We thought that was hilarious. No one else did. But they're honest choices. There were some people that will, you know, just, I did it my way. You know what I mean? Just what a massive fuck you to, no matter what they did. And often people that were arseholes as well. Like, so they were arseholes throughout their life. And then their final thing is, and a final double fuck you from the grave here. Hashtag sorry, not sorry.
I've so loved chatting to you, Jeff. I need to ask, so before I go, what's Lily's plans for the day then? And why is she called Lily, by the way? Was that Sebastian that named her, or you? And
No. She was called Lily. Lily Allen was really famous at that time. And we had a cat called Dizzy. He was Dizzy Rascal from when he was famous at that time. And so we just thought we'd have two kind of icons of British popular music in our house.
I love that.
So Lily's plans will be just hanging out from when the evening walk comes, which will be between 5 and 7. I'll get the stairs, meaningful stairs, between 5 and 7. I'm going to make myself, like, we've got lamb left over from Easter, so I'm going to make a lamb sandwich. So the next big deal moment in her day could be a little scrap of lamb. Does Raymond, I can see Raymond in shot now. Does he? I can't see his face. It's so weird.
I need to adjust the lighting so you can see him.
It'd be really fine. Now, the comic payoff now is that his face is even more scary when you put on the light. Like, absolute
not scary, Jeff.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, very cute. Yes, yeah. It's not a demon. You understand, for a while, what I was seeing was like a mop of like almost human style centre parting with sort of slightly red eyes emerging from the fringe.
Jeff, I've really loved talking to you today. Normally at this point, the dogs say goodbye, but Lily is indisposed.
Yeah, she's preening herself. She's lying in self-regard somewhere.
Can you say goodbye to Raymond?
I'll say goodbye to Raymond. Take care, mate. Make sure she gets you clipped. Not murdered, but...
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that. And do remember to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.